Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. I'm Charlotte Metcalf, and my guest today is a well-known and highly respected journalist, author and podcaster. He's been a politician and a political advisor to John Major when he was Prime Minister, and to William Hague when he was Conservative Party leader, and to others. He joined The Times in 2001, where he's a political columnist and associate editor, and has also written a regular column for the Jewish Chronicle since 2010. He also writes about football as a passionate supporter and indeed a director of Chelsea. He's been named Political Journalist of the Year and has also won Political Commentator of the Year not once but thrice. He's also written a widely acclaimed memoir about his family, Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad. He was appointed to the House of Lords in 2013 as a life peer. Danny Finkelstein, a very warm welcome to Radio Oldie.
Thank you for having me. I sound amazing. I can't wait to hear my podcast.
Well, now, we first met back in 1999 when you were advising William Hague and I was making a Channel 4 documentary about him. Then you tried to be the Conservative candidate for Harrow West and shortly afterwards joined The Times. What made you take that leap from politics into journalism?
I
mean,
first of all, obviously I was working for the Conservative Party when you met me, and then in 2001 when I'd run for Parliament and hadn't won, it wasn't really viable to go on working for another leader I didn't have a relationship with, and in any case, Ian Duncan Smith and I wouldn't have been a good fit particularly. And I'd been a journalist before I went to work in politics, so I'd worked as a trade journalist. I always liked writing and expressing myself, and one of the main things I did for William was writing speeches or helping him write speeches, which George Osborne, who also did it, compared to taking free kicks for Beckham. So writing speeches for William Hague is an extraordinary experience because he's so good at doing them, but he didn't have time to obviously do all his own. So he trusted me with them, and I therefore wanted, you know, to carry on something that would use my writing skill.
So before we get on to your journalism, can we delve into your politics a bit more? Because you actually used to be an active member of the Social Democrats and were very close to David Owen until 1988. What made you become Conservative?
Yeah, look, I've definitely moved my position on some political issues, and I've become economically, from that early period, which is now, you know, 40 years ago, I've become more economically liberal, so I'm more free market orientated than I was. But there's always been a strong streak of the same sort of politics. I'm a political moderate. I'm moderately socially conservative as well. So I've always been for gay rights and gay marriage, and I'm an anti-racist. But on the other hand, I've always felt the country needs to have a strong immigration policy. I've generally favoured pro-marriage policies. I've been a social conservative, and I do believe that nation states are the best way to organise ourselves, not through large global bodies, even though you have to cooperate within them. So my politics hasn't changed vastly, but obviously the political landscape changes around you. And so when I was working as a journalist for a trade journalist earlier in my career, there'd been a strike in the business. I thought the strike was absolutely ridiculous, and it was a strike essentially involved the management's right to manage the organisation, mixed in with whether or not we wanted to introduce new technology, which to my mind seemed like a very good thing. And I thought this was ridiculous, but found that I was part of a sort of union body, the National Union of Journalists, which had all sorts of cliches that were more appropriate to Arthur Scargill in the miners' strike about crossing picket lines and about union organisation. And I just thought, I'm in the wrong strand of politics here. My instinctive attitudes don't really suit the centre-left. They're closer to the centre-right. And I'm always reminded of that every time there's, for example, a railway workers' strike. My visceral reaction is opposition, where I suppose on the left you would begin by thinking maybe they have a point.
Well, do you think they have a point at the moment?
No, I don't. And in fact, what they're doing is exploiting a monopoly position. I remember having a discussion with a group of lawyers who'd gone on strike, and actually I was rather sympathetic to, very unusually in this way, to the bar strike, because I do feel the state is completely underpaying and therefore undersupplying criminal lawyers. But I was trying to say to them, if I support your cause, I don't want you to spend all of the money that we're going to win from this on increased train fares in order to pay these drivers who have been overpaid. And I couldn't understand why they felt their cause and the driver's cause was the same thing. It seemed to me obvious that they were both competing for resources, and if we paid the money to the train drivers, we wouldn't have it for the criminal lawyers. And I couldn't... One part of my politics, most of the time, seems to argue about what appears to me basic maths.
Are you quite glad not to be so active politically now?
I believe in politics itself. And when anyone says they don't like politicians, I had this yesterday when I was in Liverpool Labour conference and I was getting a lift and somebody said, oh, I dislike all politicians. And I said, what's your alternative to politicians? There's no alternative really to representative politicians. There's direct democracy, which certainly wouldn't work, or there's dictatorship. So we have to have politicians. Like anybody, politicians are flawed and you can worry about the quality of the individuals, but I really believe in the political system, and I want it to work, and I'm happy to be engaged with politicians and with politics. So at the moment it's hard to be fully engaged just because it's hard to find a place to put my feet, to be honest. It seems so obvious that the Conservative Party had run out of road at the last election, but as we got close to the election, my position was that of the Times newspaper that I worked for, which was, well, we could see that it was time for a change, but we couldn't endorse Labour. And that was the feeling I had, which has been amply vindicated, because I just don't think, you know, that the country's, the direction that Keir Starmer's now taking the country, generally speaking, is the right one.
You've been on a lot of think tanks. In fact, we've served for the same think tank that I came after you.
Yeah, so I'm president of Onward, but I started as the director of the Social Market Foundation, and in between those two things, I was a chairman of Policy Exchange.
If you had to sort of sum up really what Onward stands for, you know, what's its biggest sort of idea that you're pushing at the moment?
So my own view is that there's that famous James Carville statement she put on the wall of the Clinton War Room, which was, it's the economy, stupid.
Yes.
I think that the economy drives a lot, a huge amount, and that at the base of disillusion with government, distrust of politicians, is not actually a lot of the cultural issues which we're arguing about. It's the economy and how well-off people are. Mm. And that because people feel loss so keenly, you almost certainly can't satisfy those feelings of economic dissatisfaction purely by redistribution. You have to do it by wealth creation. So our biggest interests are in wealth creation. We're just at the moment thinking about how best to advance the growth agenda. And our feeling definitely is that the country, that Britain as a country, is pessimistic. It's not, tried to achieve lots and lots of other objectives through its economic policy other than growth, one of which is, you know, an energy policy that's pushed up energy prices, and we don't think is necessarily going to make the world a greener place either. So those are the areas in which we're concentrating our work, and we'll be successful if we can promote that.
Let's get on to your book now.
Yes.
Because I think it was amazing that you've found time to write it. And what took you down that path? Did you know all that about your parents, or when did you start finding out about it? When did because your father died, didn't he?
Yes, both my parents died.
Both your parents died.
So, but my book's called Hitler, Stalin, Mum and Dad, which is a summary of what it's about.
Yes.
And it's my parents. My mother was a survivor of Belsen concentration camp. My father was a survivor of a state collective farm in the borders of Siberia, his father having gone to the Gulag. So they were victims of Stalin and Hitler. And I've always known those stories, and I've always known it was my responsibility to write it. So my sister became a civil servant, a permanent secretary of DEFRA, she was, and my brother was chief scientific advisor for national security. They're both involved in public services. They're both good writers, but they don't have time to do that. And I was the writer of the three of us. Mm-hmm. So it was my responsibility. And when my parents died, when my mum died, all of their papers were in her study. There were some that were also... My grandfather was one of the great archivists of the 20th century, really. She was he was the archivist of the Nazi rise and of Nazi crimes. And his material was used in Nuremberg and at the Eichmann trial. So he kept a lot of papers as well, both at home and in his library. So there was a lot of paper available to me, and it was a story that had to be told. It had to be told for a number of reasons. One, obviously, it was my family duty. Secondly, I'm a journalist, and this is an amazing story.
It's an amazing story.
She'd have to be an idiot to have that story. And in fact, weirdly, I knew I had to tell this story, and I also wanted to write a book. I've always wanted to write a book. I love books. I sort of feel as though I take out so much from books that I ought to put in, you know, at least one book. So I set about doing it, and I did have one bit of good fortune, was that the world stopped. In other words, just as I was having this idea, I'd spent kind of like a year while doing other things, reading the background on both the Soviet and Nazi rises and crimes, and then COVID happened, and so suddenly I was at home. I just thought, right, I'm going to do this now. So my mother's story, the way I put it, is my mother's story is a kind of well-known story, of which hers is an extraordinary version. But because my grandfather, Alfred, was quite a well-known personality in that field, I mean, obviously, most people don't know him, but you know, when he died, he had obituaries in all the main papers in the world.
My grandfather,
Alfred Wiener, comes back from the war in 1918, and then in 1919, he, as a result of his experience in the war, he writes a booklet that says we're in danger of anti-Jewish pogroms in this country that will mean that we are that we speak to our descendants of bestial murder unless we do something. And he was probably, you know, historians do think this, one of the very first people in the world to think this was going to happen. And then in the mid-1920s, he thought, not only do I think it's going to happen, but I think it's Hitler is the person who's going to make it happen. That was more controversial even than his original judgment. He was already working as one of the leaders of Berlin's Jewish community, and they weren't sure that he was right. He used, which is fascinating for me given what I do, a lot of electoral data to demonstrate that he was right. He showed that the places in the world that were in Germany that were turning towards the Nazis, and he began to collect everything that he could lay his hands on that spoke of Nazi policy and potential Nazi danger, and tried to use those things to persuade others, which obviously he fails to do. So we had that archive and that work, and that meant that I did have the basics of the story. And therefore, for my mother's story, I think I would have been able to write a book about my mum. My father's story, by contrast, is actually the same story that happens to hundreds of thousands of people, his deportation, and to my grandfather, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people who went to the Gulag in the same way that Dolu, my grandfather, did. But because it's much less well known, if you go out and try and find books on that, you'll find a lot of self-published memoirs, often not superbly written, very moving, but not written by professionals is what I meant. And it's much less easy to piece together what happened specifically, because it's not very well documented. So, for example, my grandfather was in the Gulag. There's no trace there. If you were to travel to it, they'd deny it was there.
Yeah.
That's not like going to Belsen, where I went recently for a commemoration. I mean, you can't obviously even go to Russia now because it's too dangerous. So that's what if my father had not left 4 hours of video talking about his experience, which allowed me then, I had that ad and I had quite a bit of correspondence, and the two together, and then using these other memoirs, allowed me to piece that story together. But otherwise, without him, I think it would have been very difficult.
Did they ever talk to you about their experiences? I mean, particularly your mother, did she ever talk to you about Belsen while she was alive? She did.
Absolutely. Now, when I say all the time, what I mean by that is when I asked.
Yes.
So when I didn't ask, she would My mother was a very sort of modest person, and she wouldn't have wanted to bore on about it. I know that sounded a bit funny. I remember her once asking, in all seriousness, she went to speak at the synagogue. It was one of the first speeches she'd made. It was in the late 1980s. And she asked me, do you think they'll be interested in the fact that I saw Anne Frank in Belsen? Because my mother had known Anne Frank.
Yes.
And I said, well, of course, Mum. You know, I mean, I was only 18, but I was journalist enough to know that, even at that point. She didn't bore. She was afraid of being boring about it. And she also didn't want us to live in it. She did want to tell people about it. However, I asked her lots of questions.
I'm really interested about how you pass this on to your sons, and also the impact of what on earth is going on in Israel at the moment on them and your family.
Okay, so there are a number of things. First of all, obviously, one of my main ways of passing it on to the whole family was writing this book.
Yeah.
So they've now got the whole story. And my oldest son in particular...
How old is he?
He's 25 now. And he got himself involved. This is when he was 23. He was helping me edit 23. Mm-hmm. He helped me with book editing. Mm-hmm. And he's very skilled at. And so he takes a great interest in the whole story and an intimate interest in it. So that's one of the ways I convey it is that the interesting question of Israel. Obviously, that's a big issue for us.
Mm.
The important thing to understand about the Jews of the 1920s and 30s is that Zionism was not a universal position, and my grandfather was not a Zionist. Neither grandfather was a Zionist. My grandfather Dolu was less political; he was a businessman. But his view was, we live here in Poland and we're going to stay in Poland. But my grandfather, Alfred, was much more active because he was a Jewish community leader. One of the challenges to him was, why are we staying here? Right? This is dangerous here. And why are we fighting for political and social equality in a country that doesn't want to accord that to us? You're yourself saying there's all this anti-Semitism. There's like a simple solution to that. Let's not live with all these anti-Semites. And Alfred's answer was, well, that's fine, but where you're proposing to go, first of all, there are a lot of people there who don't like you either. And I'm an Islamic scholar. That's what Alfred's PhD was in. Was in stories of Islamic hardship, was Islamic teaching. That was what he was interested in. He was an Arabist and Islamic scholar, and he said there are a lot of people there, you know, dignified, good people, but they don't want this, so you will be battling them. But also, physically, there's not enough space anyway.
No.
If you've got all the Jews in the world. Now, clearly, what happened after the war was two things. First of all, there was enough space because Hitler had killed so many Jews. So now Israel has half the Jews in the world. They live in Israel. Secondly, it became a practical rather than ideological issue, which was there were hundreds of thousands of Jews who had nowhere else to go. He'd been able to come to Britain because it helped the British war effort, but there, a lot of people didn't have that position. They couldn't go home. My father, for example, he came here with the Polish Resettlement Corps, but they couldn't have gone back to Lviv. And, you know, what I write in the book is Alfred was worried that Jews would be in a constant battle if they went to Palestine, and the Zionists said, we can't stay here because they'll kill us all. And they were both right. That is the tragedy for the Jews. And the reason why Jewish people are quite stubborn about the issue of Israel is enough now. We've got to actually, one of these places, we've got to say, well, no, we're not going to be pushed out of them. Now, are the methods being used to to protect a Jewish state necessary? And has a kind of arrogance, I suppose, in their position arisen to the point where they now think we won't have any Palestinian state alongside Israel? And I think that's a strategic and moral error. I've always had it. But I understand why it's been politically dominant. The reason is because the view of two-state solution Jews in Israel and outside Israel looked impossibly naive. However, my view is a two-state solution is both you know, moral and strategic, and morally right and strategically necessary. And, you know, I very much worry if, you know, to the extent to which Israel's actions in Gaza have moved from simply being protective to one that says we're going to drive these people out altogether, which is completely unacceptable to me as a policy. I'm very willing to say those things that I've just said. They're quite critical of Israeli policy. I'm very concerned about it. But I don't find it's ever reciprocated, or rarely reciprocated, when you're having an argument with people who say it's free Palestine. Do those people accept, well, you can do that, but you have to have a safe free Palestine that Israel can live alongside? And I find it, without that, this whole conversation is pointless. And the way I always put it to people who come to talk to me, I say, you can read your talking points to me. I even know what's on them. And quite a lot of them, and quite a lot of them aren't wrong, right? Was it reasonable for Palestinians to not wish the Jewish settlers to form a state in a territory in which they also had designs on completely, right?
Yes.
Was the war that took place then awful, and were some people driven out during that war? Yes. Has Netanyahu turned against a two-state solution? Clearly. Are the West Bank settlers oppressive, and does that oppression of West Bank settlers incite violence as a response, or yes, right? So I know what's on the other sheet of paper, and lots of those things I agree with. Mm-hmm. It's just getting us absolutely nowhere.
Yes.
For me to just read out my own list of replies to all of those things, that Israel needs to exist, that Hamas is a violent organisation that started October the 7th. Both of these things are both true. The things on your piece of paper and the things on mine, and they're getting us nowhere reading them to each other. So why don't we swap pieces of paper? I'll read yours. You try reading mine. And the thing that distresses me is I do read theirs, and when I hand mine back, you do not read it. So I just want a sensible discussion of this, and it's so difficult to have it because everyone just wants to read slogans at each other.
Yes, it's so true. What do you think of Trump's proposal?
If everyone can agree to it, I think it's extraordinary and wonderful. And, while obviously it's a bit ridiculous saying it was the greatest day in the history of civilization ever, which is what he did say, it certainly is great. So I'm astonished that it would work. I would say it proves the following. It does prove that Netanyahu's offence in Gaza has reached the point where Hamas is, if it concedes to this, I think it is essentially conceding defeat, but also it represents a recognition by Netanyahu that at some point he has to accede to American limits and accept the two states that he doesn't want. So both sides, it's quite significant if they are actually able to agree on that. But I think, you know, the killing is so heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. It's terrible.
And it has to stop. So if this is a method of stopping it, then obviously I rejoice.
For you personally and your family, how do you stay kind of optimistic and positive with the anti-Semitism that's been so rife?
Okay, so I'll say two things. When you read Alfred's pamphlet in 1919 about their anti-Semitism in Germany, you're excited to two reactions. The first is, so this is how it starts, right? The second thing you think is, it's not nowhere near as bad as that now, so let's keep it in proportion. The interesting thing is, when I published the book, I was asked that question a lot, and I always gave that answer. Only a year after, the last time I was asked that, I now feel that second part, the bit about proportion, is just a little bit more iffy.
Yes.
And I have to say, the it's not just anti-Semitism, right? You've got to stay away from the fact it's real racism against Muslim people in Britain.
Yes.
So it presents itself in Tommy Robinson as super pro-Israel, but only because he hates the Muslims, right? And I find that that's not a basis for anything, for any Jewish person who wants to live here. This is something, if you're the son of refugees in this country, you should feel uncomfortable about. And by the way, I'm really, really... I opposed and have done, ever since I worked for William, ever since we first met, I've been strongly opposed to mass migration, which I think was a reckless error, because multi-ethnic societies are really hard. You can have a small number of people come into a society and slowly those people integrate, you can build up, you can have more, but moving very large quantities of people into the same cities where they can create entire groups of people who don't really relate to the outside world is always going to be difficult, because a lot of politics then ends up in a victimhood competition in which first the minority claims victimhood, and then the worst thing, which is now what's happening, you get a kind of white majority victimhood. It's really dangerous. And so I thought this policy was incredibly mistaken. I'm not for open borders, but what I am for is treating people who already live here with respect and affection and compassion, respect to their rights, and doing everything a responsible leader can to encourage people to get along with each other, because what's the alternative to that? And I don't mean by that being, first of all, people coming here illegally. That is still a crime, and it should be, it's a crime, and we should be tough on that. Nor do I mean ever. I was shown an extraordinary document earlier today in which the College of Policing was arguing that racial equity was not the same as racial equality, and they should not be colourblind in the way they treat people. Which I found, explicitly, right? So it's extraordinary. And I find that absolutely outrageous and ridiculous. We do need to treat people who are here, and the political leaders of this country need to treat people who are here with respect and encourage people to be coherent and ensure real racial equality, because, if you're a young black man, for example, you are quite likely to get arrested by the police not necessarily having done anything, right? And that's not a society that we should encourage or want.
So now you're in the House of Lords. How's that? How are you very actively engaged in that?
Yeah, so I would say I'm quite engaged in it. House of Lords turns out to be quite difficult to do properly while you're doing something else, because, for example, the debate lasts the whole afternoon and I've got meetings with things that I'm doing.
Yeah.
So it's hard to do, but when I can, I am engaged with it, and obviously there's an opportunity to vote on really important things. And at the moment, we've got super important debates going on about assisted dying. I'm in favour of assisted dying, but I'm very open to having a discussion about ways in which we can make that bill better.
Are you on the whole, your older son is 25. How old's your younger son?
18.
18. So are you optimistic about their future in this country?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I am. You could say, go. Well, where? Right?
Where?
So my view is Britain remains that Britain is one of the best places in the world for anybody to live. I often say, we have all this talk all the time, the country's broken. One of the things that writing my book has convinced me is that we don't know what broken is. That is a ridiculous idea.
That's really interesting, Danny. Yeah.
There are lots of ways in which this country could be improved, right? Mm-hmm. And you take any example, the policing, which we've talked about, the train service, the fact that we don't police shoplifting properly, the delays in healthcare, which you might not get in other countries. There are lots of ways in which we could do better in this country. There are things that we're doing better, like schooling, but definitely there are things that we're getting wrong, and I don't deny any of this. But nevertheless, if you live in Britain in the 21st century and you are yourself a middle class or upper middle class person, you are objectively living one of the greatest, most prosperous lives in the history of mankind, with less wars, less disease, longer lives, more money, more liberalism and tolerance, democracy than any time ever in any place. So yes, we've got things that are wrong, but that's certainly one of the perspectives that I got from the book. And I happen to think, for all the things that challenge Britain, and I am really worried about the ways of our politics. Like, any reasonable assessment is that a reform victory at the next general election is very possible. I worry less about Nigel Farage, interestingly, than I do about a lot of people that would come in with him, and about what sort of government that would be in terms of its attitude to some of the controlling institutions, from the courts to the BBC to the civil service. I still think there's an awful lot that's right about the British way of life and British traditions, which, ironically, considering that they want everybody to have a flag on their house, they're against. I'm obviously like super patriotic British person, and I've been in the Conservative Party for most of my adult life, with all that that means in terms of my social attitudes, but I don't want to be bullied into putting up a flag in order to demonstrate my political allegiance, even in a soft way, even in an sort of not explicit way.
And obviously you have taught your sons not to take any bullying. Yeah.
Neither. I mean, fortunately, my boys are like tall. I married a 6 foot girl, so my my older sons are 6 foot four and 6 foot two. And I remember that when Aaron, my middle son, we used to go to football, and we go to football together, and we used to go to football in the Lower West Stand at Chelsea, and I turned around to him and said to him, can you see? Because, you know, when the kids are small, they can't see the goals. And he turned around to me and went, I'm 6 foot four, Dad. Right? The person behind me can't see. We had another occasion where he went without me, and my wife said to him, you're going to be all right, Aaron? And he goes, what, without Dad? And she goes, yes. And he goes, what is Dad going to do? So fortunately, my children they won't be bullied by anyone.
Good. Well, what a lovely place to end, Danny. It's been so nice to catch up with you again after all these years.
And too.
You are just as you ever were.
Well,
you know, fair, also, passionate.
But also know that I'm in the hands of a master. You know, you're so good at putting people at their ease, that William Hague and I and George, who did Prime Minister's Questions, we gave away far too much. And Philip Gould told me afterwards, who worked for Tony Blair, that they watched that documentary that you made, and they realised how we were preparing Prime Minister's Questions, and they changed their whole method. And actually, it was a bit of a nightmare for quite a while, because you made us so relaxed that we, and I've probably done it on this as well, that we just sort of felt we could say anything. I noticed myself, I was thinking, God, why are you saying that? It's because of you, so you remain the professional that you've always been.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. It's been an absolute joy. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to me, Charlotte Metcalf, in conversation with Danny Finkelstein. If you've enjoyed it and would like to hear more like this, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk, where you'll also be able to subscribe to the magazine. My very warm thanks to Danny, to Bailey Gifford for sponsoring us, and to you for listening. Goodbye. You've been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? I'm sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter Old Trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter Old Trial.